This week on C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast, Newsweek's Batya Ungar-Sargon speaks about the lives of working-class Americans and the policies they believe could help get them to the middle class. Reason senior editor Ravi Suave interviews her.
Since March 19, 1979, C-SPAN, a public service funded by the cable television industry, began giving you direct access to government in an innovative way by putting you, the viewer, into the rooms where politics is debated and policies are determined. C-SPAN began as a bold initiative. Now, 45 years later, we are essential for those wanting to see democracy at work, without editing or commentary. With continued cable support, we've done this without a dime of government funding, maintaining our independence. As we mark 45 years, the business of media is rapidly changing, and now your support is crucial for our mission's future. Support our legacy of unfiltered access by donating today at cspan.org/donate. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Well, it's my pleasure to discuss Second Class with the author, my dear friend, Batya. Batya, how are you doing?
I am so happy to be here with you, Robbie. There's something the audience needs to know about you before we get started, and it's this. Most people in our industry think that they are very generous people, but they are actually stingy Grinches. You are a very generous person, but you like to pretend that you are a stingy Grinch, all of which I say because I know we're going to have a very heated conversation here. You don't agree with all of my views, and I cannot be more excited for it.
I'm excited as well, and while I don't agree with everything in the book, I found it to be a really fascinating profile of so many working class people. You did just tremendous reporting for it. So let's get right into it. First, start with an easy question. What inspired you to write this book after doing your first book about the news industry, the media, and how that had changed from a working class profession to an elite profession? I see how this follows logically from that, but could you tell us more about your process of actually writing this book?
Absolutely. So in my first book, Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy, what I found was that the main characteristic of our news media, which is suffering from just historic lows in trust, was not that it was politically partisan, but that it was made up of the over-credentialed college elites. A class divide has come to define American life, and our news media is very much on the side of one of the halves of that divide, the college educated. And as I was writing that book, I came to understand something that I think is really fundamental about America and yet totally misunderstood. And it's this, Robbie. Americans are much more united than we are divided. And that includes on all of the issues that our media and our politicians are super divided on. Issues like guns and abortion and race and healthcare. These are all issues that the parties are super divided on, but the American people are not. And because our media is so weighted in favor of the elites and the interests of the elites, we don't hear from the working class. And it was that insight that the vast majority of Americans who are more united than divided have effectively been deplatformed from American public view that made me want to write a book that really explored who is the American working class. Do they still have a fair shot at the American dream? How do they see their role in America? And what would America look like if we were centering their voices?
So let's define some terms. How do we actually define the working class? Is it simply people who don't have college degrees, or are they in a certain income, below a certain income threshold? Do they work certain jobs? What do you mean when you say the working class?
This is such an important question, and the answer is it is very difficult to define. I'm going to tell you how I define it in a minute, but first, a word on the difficulties. You know, we know, for example, that there is a big overlap between income and culture and class, but these things don't map very neatly onto each other. I'm sure all of us know in our lives an electrician or a plumber who makes maybe more money than we do, right? Although that is obviously a classically working class job. Another problem is that people whose parents have a college education are often more likely to have access to that kind of an education and thus to the American dream. How do we define it intergenerationally? How do we define it in terms of income? Also, Robbie, as you know, Americans think of this as a classless society. And so though we have come to be defined very much in class terms, as I argue in Second Class, Americans don't necessarily see themselves as working class. And so having this conversation involves many steps of definitions and qualities and life and culture and region. What might be considered working class in some parts of the country would be considered middle class in other parts of the country, because the cost of living is so radically different between, let's say, Los Angeles and something like West Virginia, right? The way that I eventually ended up defining working class, and it's a little clunky, so bear with me, but it's people who work in a job that do not require skills you learn in college, who are not part of the top 20%. So I'm not talking about rich plumbers, right? I'm talking about people who effectively are working in working class jobs, jobs that require physical labor or other things that you don't necessarily learn in college, although some of the people in my book have a college degree, who have been locked out of the top 20%. That's the kind of clunky definition that I felt most characterized the kind of people that I feel have been sort of erased from public view. And also, it was a good proxy for the phenomenon that I'm trying to describe, which is that divide, the chasm separating out the fortunes of people who have a college degree, who are much more likely to become homeowners, who live much longer, who are able to retire in dignity, versus the working class, whose lives have become increasingly characterized by precariousness.
Well, and let's talk about that. How do you think their lives have changed over the last 100 years? I think when you think of, you know, we tend to romanticize the past a little bit, or at least I think people romanticize the past, say, oh, you know, things were so much better in, say, the 50s, or I guess now we're far enough along, maybe I'm romanticizing like the 80s and the 90s, the time of my childhood, but that it used to be a time where people could work, save, afford houses, buy a car, acquire material wealth, move up in their positions, and then leave a better future for their children. Has that actually changed in the last half century or more?
Well, we know that 1971 was the high water mark for working class wages. And after that, productivity and profit continued to skyrocket. But working class wages stagnated, and with inflation today, they've actually fallen. So there's a very objective way to measure this. You know, the rate of home ownership has actually not changed significantly. It's around 63%. But if you separate out the working class, it's really fallen drastically. And that's because so many more people are going to college. About a third of Americans go to college. And so it would make sense that that rate would hold. But it is increasingly a privilege that you need a college degree in order to enjoy. Now, again, this is not true across the nation. You can be pretty poor in West Virginia and own your own home. The American dream is paradoxically doing better for working class people in red America, simply because if you define, you know, the American dream and a middle class life as having a sort of home ownership component, the way that the vast majority of Americans do, housing in blue America has just become completely unaffordable. And we can get into the reasons why and the solutions for that, which, Robbie, I think you'll like, because they're all market driven.
That was the solution I liked the best. You ended with that one. We will definitely get to that. So first, a little bit more on this, though, because I know people will say, who maybe, you know, don't necessarily disagree with you on a lot of your premises in the book, but I think, right, some of the wages, doesn't it depend a little bit if we're counting, like, house, you know, the average wage of the household actually has fewer people in it now, so Like the number of cars owned per person in the household is, I think, larger. The actual, again, material goods in the house, even for relatively not as well-off people, have internet access and laptops, and TVs are cheaper than ever, and there's more likely to be air conditioning and indoor plumbing, way more likely are in America, frankly, than in a lot of our even European peer countries that we think of as, you know, they take care of everything, but they have smaller apartments and homes and don't have as much access to those things. So a lot of that has gotten better, even if the wages maybe have not kept up the way we'd like them to. And then, of course, we'll talk about, right, all of the sort of labor-intensive services like education and healthcare that have gotten way, way less affordable. I totally agree on those.
Yeah, so I think the point I would make is this is not a book about the poor. Although there are people in the book who have one, two, three jobs, who work and work and work and are poor, are constantly having to call the electric company and beg forbearance and create payment plans and so forth, driving around in cars with no windows because they can't afford to fix them. But this is a book about the working class. So sure, people can afford flat screen TVs, but if you can't afford to buy a home to put it in, and you have nothing to leave to your children, and your children have fewer possibilities than you and are downwardly mobile, if you can't afford healthcare, which I know we're going to agree on, if you cannot afford to retire, and you don't have a home to retire to, it seems to me that there's something unforgivable in an elite class that has taken all of those things for granted, saying it's okay with me that the woman who comes to clean my home will never be able to stop working until the day she dies, even though her work is so much more physically demanding than mine, right? It's not about people living in, you know, boxes in the streets without plumbing. It's about the fact that the elites are hoarding the American dream for themselves while relying on the labor of the working class who no longer have access to those things. So I think let's define the American dream, right? So we can talk about what is the thing that has become unaffordable. These people, what they want, I mean, Robbie, it brings tears to your eyes how modest their desires are. And I hope people will read the book because there are so many people in this book that I want you to meet. I want you to hear in their own words, because these people are not resentful. They are simply hopeless. And their desires are so modest. What they want, how do they define the American dream? So the majority of people I interviewed would say it means the ability to own your own home at some point, to retire in dignity, to have your children have at least as many choices as you do, and to have adequate health care. I mean, these are such modest things. Unfortunately, we sold out the working class who could used to be able to in the 70s rely on being able to afford those things if they work hard. And in exchange, we gave them flat screen TVs. And I think you can see why that to them seems sort of like not a great bargain.
And I want to emphasize, your book is just so impressive in terms of the number of people you interviewed in these working class people, but in vastly different circumstances. It really is a very impressive work of reporting, because this is not just an op-ed or an economics paper about, you know, what you think are the right solutions. It is substantively a very comprehensive series of interviews with these fascinating people that I learned a lot from, and people should definitely read it. Can I ask you how you about your reporting process? I'm interested as a journalist. How did you meet these people? And can you talk to us more about that?
Yeah, that was definitely the hardest part. First of all, thank you for saying that, Robbie. I so appreciate that. I wanted to interview people who I felt were representative of not just their stories, but a larger trend or a larger group of Americans, but also people who are interesting in their own right. So it was a sort of, that was the biggest challenge. I did about 100 interviews, from which I think there's about 20, 23 people who are deeply profiled in the book. And the way I chose the people was, I first went to this wonderful professor at Brigham Young University, Joe Price, who has a team of research assistants, grad students. And what he will do is he will allow journalists like me to hire them out to create a quantitative analysis. And so they took the American Census survey. I asked for them to compare 2020 to 2000 so I could see the trends developing in the last 20 years. And they did a breakdown of who is the American working class. So I had this kind of eagle eye data analysis of how many people are there, how much are they making, where do they live, where are the home ownerships highest? Which industries have the highest levels of home ownership? And all of this is in the book. And then I went and looked for people who were representative of those trends that I saw so that I wouldn't be picking and choosing and cherry picking. I really wanted to combat my own confirmation bias in terms of what I was looking for. And honestly, I was very surprised by a lot of the findings in the book. One of the most surprising things was I didn't interview a single Black man who was planning to vote for Joe Biden. And at the time I thought, well, that's weird. But now when you look at the polling, it makes a lot of sense because that is a huge trend developing among voters of color who are working class, defecting from the Democratic Party. Another thing that I was very surprised to find was I really thought that, you know, the thesis was going to be, you know, that the American dream is totally inaccessible to the working class. Not true. That is not so. The skilled trades still provide a very strong foundation for working class Americans to achieve the American dream, which is why it is outrageous, Robbie, that we give $200 billion a year to fund higher education universities and colleges, and only $1 billion to vocational training, which was gutted under President Obama in favor of sending people to college. It's totally unforgivable because that is one of the pathways to the American dream that has just been intentionally shrunk down.
Yeah, let's actually talk about this at greater length. I think this is an area of agreement between us. Frankly, if there's a villain in your book, it seems to me to be the college diploma, and very deservedly so. That emerges that the kind of worst off people are people who attempted or felt pushed or encouraged to get a college degree, who took out loans to get it, and then either, you know, ended up getting a degree in something that doesn't render you particularly employable, or, you know, can't not even as close, nearly as close to a vocational kind of trade. Or people who just didn't finish college and then they still have the debt. They're the worst off of all. But our policies have explicitly encouraged this choice that ends up just being an extra hoop for so many people to jump through that costs them money before they can qualify for work. And what it seems to me, and correct me if this is a misperception, that a lot of these people who you've profiled who struggle to find good paying regular jobs, who often will have a job for a period of time and then have to go take a different job. Part of it is because they're competing with people who do have college degrees. The college degree doesn't really help them do the job better, but because they have this extra credential, and I'm all for competition, but this isn't a competition that would necessarily happen, right? Even in a free market, this is a competition that's happening because there's a massive subsidy to people who jump through the hoop, or there's massive encouragement. They have to end up paying it back afterward. But it's perverse and distorted incentives that are forcing people down a path that doesn't actually make them more productive or better workers. It takes up more of their time, money, and energy, and then makes them taking jobs for people who didn't have the opportunity to do that, who would be perfectly fine in those jobs.
No notes. That's perfect. I totally agree with that. And that is how working class people sound when they talk about the diploma divide. There are people in the book who really wanted to go to college and couldn't afford it. One person especially, Cyrus, he would have been an amazing lawyer. But most of the people I profiled had no interest in going to college. They really, really valued and got dignity from the working class jobs that they did. But you're right that some had been pushed to go to college and all had been told in high school that you're a loser if you don't go to college and this is for the dumb losers. And it is madness. It is madness. It is not only infuriating, like you said, that these people have student loans for jobs that don't require a college degree if they dropped out. And by the way, though, we know that 50% of college graduates are underemployed, meaning they are also doing jobs that you don't require a college degree to learn the skills, although infuriatingly, they are still making more money than people who didn't go to college trying to do those same jobs, exactly like you said, Robbie. It's absolutely infuriating. And the thing is we actually need more skilled trades folks. There is a huge dearth of skilled trades folk in America. And instead of encouraging that and giving thanks to these people for doing these jobs that we, the college educated, would rather not do, and they are happy to do, We have instead devalued those jobs, insulted them for doing them, and then made them pay less and less and less with every year as we plundered the middle class, and our jobs paid more and more and more. And that is the direct result of Democratic policy, 100%. I mean, I don't think they did this, you know, out of some evil, although I do think that they thought that the more people went to college, the more people would vote for Democrats, which is true. You know, they simply thought this was the way of the future. They didn't realize that we will always need people to change the diapers of our elderly. We're always going to need people to do that. We are always going to need truckers. We are always going to need people to clean toilets. And the fact is, there are Americans who get a lot of dignity from doing those jobs. But because the college-educated elites would rather die than do those jobs, they decided that they don't have to pay a living wage. We're going to ship good-paying jobs overseas, and then we're going to just import masses and masses of illegal immigrants to take these jobs or to lower the wages of those jobs because we in the elites didn't think that they were dignified. And there is something to me that is so godless about that, Robbie, just the absolute refusal to acknowledge how much we need these people to do these jobs and how much we simultaneously made these jobs not worthy of doing and not capable of delivering the most basic, basic, humble needs.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Let's talk about immigration, which I think really emerged as one of the more consensus views among the people you interviewed. Again, people who come from all walks of life and who are politically diverse in terms of what party they affiliate with, all seemed very skeptical of increased immigration, and particularly illegal immigration, which is, as you said, very contrary to how elites feel in this country, very supportive of immigration. You know, you kind of, I think, attempt to debunk some of the common talking points about immigration. I've used some of these in the past. We probably disagree on this, but is it really the case, do you think, that these are jobs, some of these jobs that would be done eagerly by the working class? Because the thinking is, some of these are, right, very dirty or difficult jobs, your maids, your laborers in the fields, those kinds of things. These are jobs immigrants are willing to do. It's still, for the immigrant, it's their observed preferences, right? They would rather come here and do those jobs than remain in their home country where there's maybe political persecution and violence and crime in addition to a lack of economic opportunity. They're willing to do those jobs. And is the working class really, are they taking those jobs from the working class? You really think that?
I mean, I interviewed a number of janitors who love their job. It's very hard, and they love cleaning. And they are simply unable to compete with teams that are completely staffed by illegal migrants. I'll give you a free market example of this, Robbie. There's so many examples of it, I think. CNAs, women who take care of the elderly. Of course, these are jobs that are difficult, but they get dignity out of doing these jobs. And we know that the vast majority of immigrants who came here between 1971 and now are employed in working class jobs. So, they're either taking the jobs or they're driving down the wages simply with the supply of labor. I mean, it's like obvious supply and demand. If you import 10 million people and the majority of them are going to be employed, in restaurants or in agriculture or in hospitals or as cleaning people or landscapers. Those jobs are going to have many more workers for employers to choose from, which means they're going to have to offer a lot less money for them, right? It's kind of very free market. But let me give you an example that I think you'll appreciate. There's a place where we can see a controlled experiment of the way in which illegal immigration impacts the wages of the working class, and it's Las Vegas. The average woman or man who cleans hotel rooms in Las Vegas, which is a very physically demanding job, one that surely the elites believe that no American would want, the average pay is $22 an hour, which, depending on the price of housing, is a middle-class wage. The union there gives them full health care. They don't pay any fees, any copays. They can get $20,000 help on a down payment on a home from the union. It's really, really great work. It is sort of the promised land for hospitality workers. How are they able to get paid so much? How are they able to get all these amazing benefits and working conditions? It's because of this, Robbie. The casinos are so tightly regulated. They're not allowed to hire illegal immigrants. And so there is not a single illegal immigrant employed in any of those casinos. And as a result, hospitality jobs pay a living wage. If you are a busboy, you are making a living wage. And I remember I went there, to report this out for the book. And the first thing that struck me was my first time being in Las Vegas was the swagger of the working class there. I mean, you walk around the hotels and the men working there, they'll hit on you. And I thought that was great. I mean, that won't happen to you in New York because the people employed in those jobs are either being completely undercut by low wages or they are illegal migrants. And so you really have a test case in Las Vegas of what it would look like if we actually took immigration seriously and took working class wages seriously, because it's a perfect test case where what happens is working class wages go up and up and up.
Right. I guess the concern from sort of an economist standpoint, right, is that would be like, labor is an important component of the economy, that it's a resource. If we arbitrarily cap it or cut ourselves off from that, that would be like saying, let's have less access to wood or food or metal or something like that. It raises the price of groceries, raises the price of homes, which is a major point in your book, which we're definitely going to get into in a bit. If the people producing things have to pay more to produce those things, that impacts everyone in the whole country, right?
So the answer to that, I think, let's go back to 1971, this high water mark for working class wages. And what you had there was the biggest sector of the economy was in manufacturing. And as a result, you had Americans who were employed, let's say, in auto factories, and they were making cars for the American consumer. And so the price point had to be set somewhere where both the labor of the working class worker was protected and dignified, but also where the American consumer could afford to buy that car. And the way that worked effectively was it came out of the profit margin. You didn't have corporations that did everything to try to maximize profit. What you had was bosses and owners of these car companies saying, well, I need my guys working on the line to be able to afford this car. So I need them to be making a dignified living wage, right? I mean, that's kind of how it worked. And the price point was set at a place that honored both the consumer and the producer. Now, of course, we know that we shipped 5 million manufacturing jobs off to China and Mexico. China's competitive advantage is that it doesn't pay its workers well, which is, not really a natural resource if you think about it, or at least it really shouldn't be treated as one. The largest sector of our economy today is finance, which again comes back to shareholder maximization. Now, I don't have anything against, corporations or billionaires. A lot of working class people admire billionaires. They see them as jobs creators. But I just think this idea that we have to be in a race to the bottom on behalf of the American consumer, the consumer that's being pictured there is often somebody who already has all of their most basic needs met. And the idea that in order to meet that bottom line, we would undercut our own workers seems to me to be a mistake. The truth is that the resources you mentioned, let's say wood, right, food, there is is a natural limit on how much we can have of those resources. And I think America should see labor that way. There is a natural limit on the amount of labor we can have. And it is the limit set by how do we ensure that our workers who engage in back-breaking labor that we rely on to survive can afford to feed their families and support themselves in dignity. That should be the bottom line at the end of the day.
You mentioned that a lot of the people you interviewed did not have antagonistic feelings toward billionaires or even toward big businesses. Frankly, it seemed to me that two employers in particular, Amazon and Starbucks, actually got pretty good reviews from the people you interviewed who had worked there. And there was not a hostility to organized labor, to unions, but it seemed like some of the people you talked to thought unions made sense in some situations and not others, which has frankly always corresponded with my view of unions or what I've seen of organized labor. If you have let's say, car manufacturing, you have a lot of people doing similar work that's somewhat compartmentalized, you would want to have the workers being able to negotiate on behalf of a large group. Whereas if you have, now we're seeing, for instance, journalism, our industry getting rapidly unionized. And I'm like, what is the people do? It's a creative position that people have wildly different values from month to month, depending on whether Facebook or YouTube is being kinder to our distribution models. And it doesn't make any sense. But can you talk about the view of labor and big business that you came across?
Yeah, absolutely. I know, Robbie, when I see these journalists who make $165,000 a year unionizing, I always think to myself, like, what's next? The CEO's union? Yeah. It's coming.
Well, and frankly, them doing something that one of the people you mentioned in the, or who you talked to in the book, pointed out right away, which is, if the union negotiates or you get a kind of minimum starting pay or a minimum wage, how does that impact people who are just starting off, who are maybe not, worth employing at that rate? Are you just like cutting them off from the opportunity for the company to give them a chance?
So you're totally right. Let's start with Amazon and Starbucks. I know that there is sort of Starbucks unionization efforts afoot. I was not able to find a Starbucks worker who was not happy, and they really like working for Starbucks. The place gives really, really incredible benefits. While I was reporting the book, there was a great moment, I'm sure you saw it, where Senator Bernie Sanders hauled Howard Schultz, who started Starbucks, in front of a Senate committee to sort of berate him about, union busting and so forth. And at some point, Howard Schultz looked at Senator Sanders and he said, Senator Sanders, when you wanted to come up with a minimum wage bill for the country, you were asking for $15 an hour. But my workers start at $17 an hour. Like, why are you giving me such a hard time? You only asked for $15 an hour. And, there was this sense that, Sanders' problem with Schultz was that he had opted to do this rather than been forced by the government to do it, right? Mm. I mean, clearly, Howard Schultz found a market rationale to give his workers great pay. I don't think anybody expects to be at Starbucks, for a career, although there's a lot of advanced movement up. Walmart is another good example of that. 75% of management positions at Walmart are hired from people who started out hourly. You can be a manager at a regional Walmart without a college degree making $250,000 a year. That's great stuff. I mean, Walmart started out being a place that was really harsh to its workers, and it's had a real kind of come to Jesus moment. I think literally it's a religious company. And they treat their workers, the workers there that I spoke to, that I interviewed, were really happy there. Amazon as well, I gotta say, I know that there's a lot of reporting out there about, what the warehouse is like. And I did interview somebody who at some point had worked in the warehouse and it had been really dreadful. And she's a really hard worker. And she said it was the only job that got the better of her. But I spoke to Amazon drivers and packers and people in other places who love that company and said to me, this is the best job I ever had. In terms of unions, it's very complex because on the one hand, support for unions, intellectually, emotionally, union vibes are good right now. People really appreciate unions and what they do. There's a very positive view of unions, and yet only 6% of the private sector is unionized. There simply is not a mass race to join unions despite the positive vibes people have about them right now. And I thought that was really interesting. People would say a lot, oh, I totally, I support unions. I think they're great. I just don't need it in my workplace. We could quibble. I'm sure progressives would say they're wrong. They should, and so forth. To me, the number one reason why the unions are failing to gain more purchase is because they have embraced mass migration, and they do not distinguish between legal and illegal workers, at least rhetorically, and in terms of their lobbying. And I think that for a lot of working class people, that feels like a little bit of a betrayal. Of course, there's also at the national level, the unions are super woke, and there's a vast gulf separating out culturally the union leadership from the rank and file. And you're seeing this now. Rank and file is pretty, especially in sort of the Teamsters, places like this, steel workers, the rank and file is like totally in the bag for Trump. And the leadership is out there like, endorsing Biden and so forth. But at the same time, I don't think people are rejecting unions because of that sort of cultural difference. I spoke to a lot of conservatives who are very happily in unions, electricians and so forth, who said, yeah, I know my boss is a liberal. I don't care.
It seemed like there was a great deal of political frustration at both parties. You talk to people with a lot of disaffection for Democrats and interest in Trump. Trump obviously made a big play for working class, unionized people, Rust Belt states, the Midwest, that kind of thing. Of course, then he did get to be president for a term. And do you think these people are still on the Trump train? Are they coming back to him? Or is it just they are totally unimpressed by what Joe Biden has accomplished? Maybe they're frankly unimpressed with what the major figures in both parties have promised and delivered.
I didn't speak to any Trump voters who are voting for Biden, but I spoke to a lot of Biden voters who are voting for Trump.
Feel like it making any predictions on that basis?
I am the worst prognosticator. Whatever I prognosticate, the opposite happens. So it's very hard in this moment, having written this book and spent this much time with working class people, to see how Joe Biden pulls this around. And everything the media is talking about, they're just on the wrong thing. They want to tell you that, Biden's going to lose Michigan over Gaza. He's not. He's going to lose Michigan because there's 600,000 auto workers there. And the whole EV scam was just completely punishing to them. And they know it. And they know that that's, Joe Biden tells them that's the future. They know that that is going to just sink the industry. So I sort of see everything from this class lens. Forgive me.
No, I think that makes sense. Well, and the electric vehicles subject is, it's kind of near and dear to what we're talking about here. I say, great, if those things can succeed on the market on their own, that's fine. And that's how competition works. And sorry if you work at a different company, but of course they're totally and relentlessly subsidized and pushed by government. Sometimes our government officials sound like they're making commission on selling them, which is totally the opposite of fair competition, right?
100%. And of course, this is just class warfare against the working class. The whole green agenda puts the thumb on the scales for China. And the reason that the liberals and the left are doing that is because their base wants like a nifty little Chinese EV, because all the driving they do is, the six blocks from their apartment in Brooklyn to the Whole Foods and back, right? I mean, they don't have to drive, like, they're not truckers. They don't live in rural America. They're not farmers. They don't have to drive an hour to get their kid to soccer practice. I mean, it's just it's very myopic. And service for their voters. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, this is how retail politics work. You do favors for your voters. Joe Biden wants, young voters. He give, pay off their student loans, upward transfer of wealth from the working class. It's just very important, I think, to call that out, because so much of it is done with this high-minded, as if in the name of justice. And really, it's simply, an economic play for votes. It's simply, it's pork belly spending.
Let's talk about the biggest point of agreement between us in your book. You have a wonderful section at the very end about housing and how zoning laws have made housing so unaffordable, made it more difficult to build new housing, made it more difficult to build the kind of dense housing where you can have a lot of units or a lot of people in one place. And, owning a home is, I think, correctly positioned by you as one of the major components of the American dream, the thing the working class is aspiring to achieve, something that was obtainable for them 50 or 80 years ago, and now still is, certainly in some locations in the country, depending on your circumstance. As you said, some red states doing better, and then there's always, you know, there's the blue urban area versus the red area surrounding it in many states. But, you know, talk to us about this very deliberate policy choice that has made it so difficult for, frankly, not just working class people, frankly, all of us, to afford housing.
It's definitely true. I mean, there's a lot of college-educated people in urban settings who, you know, think, I will never own a home. They will, though. I mean, it's sort of a fantasy. Right now, of course, interest rates are through the roof, but they are much more likely to be able to afford a home at some point than working-class Americans. And, you know, the reason for that is, it's hard to admit it, but, you know, Elizabeth Warren actually wrote a whole book about this called The Two-Income Trap, where she really nailed it. You know, it used to be that doctors would marry nurses and lawyers would marry secretaries. And so you had this kind of, you know, that in itself was a sort of trickle-down economics, right? Because somebody who was making a lot more money would marry someone who was making less money, and then she might even stay home, right? And they would live off the doctor's income, right? Or she would keep working as a nurse, maybe part-time, maybe full-time. But now what happens is doctors marry doctors and lawyers marry lawyers. And so you have these households that have a combined income of, you know, $500,000, $1 million a year. And working class people, right, the cleaning lady who marries the landscaper, is now left to compete for a dwindling stock of homes against the doctor and the doctor, right? So the market simply ate up the extra income of the second partner in these power couples, essentially, who define the top 10%, the top 20%, and basically have 50% of the GDP locked up. You know, they love to rail against the 1%, but really the vast majority of the gains and the plunder has been to the top 20% from the middle class. So what this has done is made housing unaffordable. And so why aren't we simply building more housing? Well, let's go back to these couples. Once they get their home, they really want to protect the value of that home. And the way that they have done that is through zoning laws. Effectively, 78% of the land that is zoned for housing on the coasts is zoned for single family detached, which means that, you know, let's say an older couple passes on and, you know, that there's a house there that's for sale. Well, a developer could come and tear down the home and build a duplex or a triple decker or maybe a little complex with four apartments in it. A nice starter home for this cleaning lady who works for somebody who lives in, you know, a nice wealthy neighborhood. But the land is zoned against that. So you can only build another single family detached home there, which protects the housing value of all these people. Now, Robbie, the dirty secret is this is happening in liberal places. This is where liberals live. They sit there and out of one side of their mouth, they talk about building affordable housing and all of this stuff, Section 8 vouchers. And on the other side of their mouth, they are making sure that the housing crisis only gets worse and worse. Now, why won't affordable housing help this problem? Why won't more vouchers help this problem? The problem there is that giving people vouchers or saying, you know, we're going to subsidize a person with a lower income living in this place, all you're doing is creating more demand, right? You're increasing the demand there, where before you had a person who could only afford to live in an apartment, but now you have a lower income person who has a voucher to live in a home. That's an extra person, right? You're only expanding demand. All of the left-wing ideas about how to help the housing crisis, they're only going to make the problem worse. The only thing that will help this problem is to increase the supply of housing. So we need to get rid of these zoning laws. We need to get rid of them. And the estimates are if we get rid of them tomorrow, we can build 1 million units in 1 year. And in a decade, we will have solved our housing crisis.
Incredible. With just that simple change, we could do it. Yeah, I very much agree with you. And I live in Washington, D.C. I've seen how the Section 8 housing, that type of stuff, fails over and over again because I think that frankly is aimed at maybe the lowest rung of the working class or actually just outright impoverished people or people who aren't working at all, who invariably those kinds of arrangements end up having to tangle with serious mental illness, crime, violence, drug addiction, those sorts of problems that can wreck those entire buildings, those end up not being places where people want to live, right? That's not the kind of, and frankly, you talk about that a lot of the book. People, the people you're talking to, don't want to be seen as recipients of government handouts, or at least undue recipients of government handouts. They don't want to be permanently on the take. They want to, they find dignity in work. They want to, you know, I think they believe there should be support for people in tough situations, but not that it should just be this permanent thing for people to get their check for the government, live in the house the government built for them, and that's just their lives. That's not really what they're looking for.
100%, and this is totally lost on liberals. They think that, you know, an agenda that caters to the poor, to the dependent poor, is, you know, that's it. That's the goal, right? They don't understand that working class people see an agenda that caters to the poor and expands the welfare state as indirect tension with their interests. They don't want welfare. They don't want handouts. They see work through a spiritual lens. They take so much pride and they get so much dignity from working, and they see it as an inheritance from their parents. They remember their parents getting dressed to go to work every day, and it makes them feel connected to their parents. It makes them feel proud to be American. They don't want to live off government handouts. But you're right. Sometimes, you know, they will see someone who they saw work and work and work, and why can't that person get help if they're in a slump, if they need it just for now, just a little bit here and there? And again, a lot of this frustration with the welfare state comes from firsthand knowledge. I mean, most of the people I interviewed knew people who they felt were scamming the system, and they felt deep frustration with that because they felt like, well, they could have chosen to do that and they didn't because they have too much dignity, and yet when they need help, they can't get it.
Yeah, I remember college students getting the, whatever they're called, different things in different states, the grocery cards, the just by using that to buy booze. You talk about a concept called the benefits cliff that's related to this. People who do have some kind of welfare and would actually stand to lose it if they increased their salary or their employment and thus are disincentivized from doing so. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? If you are a single mom, let's say, and let's say you have a kid. So there you're getting help and you're making, let's say, $10 an hour. So you're getting, you know, help in terms of food stamps. You're getting help, let's say, in terms of childcare, which is extremely expensive. And let's say your child has a disability or some sort of, you know, special need. So they're on Medicaid, right? Which is the Cadillac of health insurance. If you are such a woman and you're a hard worker and you show up to work every day on time and your boss recognizes you and your potential and says, you know what, I want to give you a raise. I want you to come on full time. I want to give you benefits and I want to give you $15 an hour. That woman will lose $25,000 a year in benefits if she takes that raise. And, you know, you might say, look, take the raise. It's fine. It'll even out. But first of all, it won't even out because $10 an hour to $15 an hour does not equal $25,000 over the course of the year. But also, it would really be, as a parent, a malpractice to do that. Why? She doesn't know how good the health insurance is going to be. She doesn't know ahead of time whether it's going to cover what her child needs, what her child is getting off of Medicaid. So many of these employer-backed insurance plans are garbage. So how can she take that raise? And I think a lot of that is why we see that so many people who are employed by these big box stores are on government benefits. It is corporate welfare. It is. They aren't paying a living wage. But at the same time, a lot of people are making that choice because they cannot, in good conscience, if they have children, give up these benefits. We have weighted the system to incentivize the worst kind of behavior, marriage. Marriage is one of the most stabilizing forces from a purely economic point of view. The average black male head of household who is single makes $33,000 a year. The average male black head of household who is married makes $95,000 a year, which is a solidly middle-class wage in most of the country. Now, why are we disincentivizing marriage? If a woman is struggling, she's working, but she's sort of making it. She's making that $10 an hour. She's got kids. She's getting help. If she does the best thing she can do and gets married, she will lose access to so many of those benefits. Now, you might say, look, she won't need them anymore. There's another income. Maybe, maybe not. but we should be incentivizing the best behaviors possible, and we should be incentivizing the kind of autonomy that the working class longs for. And instead, what we've done is incentivize dependency.
The lack of stability in the family structure does come across very clearly, not just obviously in your book, in your reporting, but in you know, works done by other people, in Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, which I'm sure was something of an inspiration for this kind of work. The fact that elite privileged people, the upper class, their divorce rates are, I think, lower than ever. They delay having children, but then they have, when they do have children, they don't have children beyond their means to take care of them, and they're very financially sound situations. Whereas working class, lower class, poorer people have just appalling rates of divorce or just not being married in the first place at all, and out of wedlock children, and more children beyond what can be supported. You know, some of this, right, is not, there are certainly government policies that can be tweaked, like what you just mentioned, what we talked about for zoning, but is it a cultural trend? Is it a social trend? Is there some kind of collapse or spiritual malaise taking place? What explains what has happened to the family stability in these kinds of working class lives?
I think there's a spiritual crisis, definitely plaguing some corners of the working class, especially young men. Because of the devaluation of working class labor, they cannot see themselves as providers. And along with that has come a kind of self-infantilization almost. You have 7 million young men who are not in the workforce, who are simply missing from the workforce. And of course, you can't ask women to marry men like that, right? I mean, living in their mother's basements and playing video games all day. I think it's very hard for women to see them that way too. And that stems both from economic and spiritual and cultural and social. It's a sort of a horrible witch's brew of, self-perpetuating forces. In retrospect, it was a really bad idea to say that masculinity itself is bad, that, you know, machismo and being a provider and being a supporter and being manly and brawn, to effectively, you know, socially and culturally criminalize all of these things through all of our culture, it's had a disastrous impact on men, women, and children. And, obviously came from a good place. People wanted women to be empowered. You know, people wanted, you know, less domestic violence or what have you. I mean, obviously there were good feelings behind this, good vibes behind this, propelling this. But, the idea that we shouldn't admire men, that, you know, men should be at the bottom of the pecking order, that they should always be second guessing natural impulses, to be, you know, macho, to have a little, you know, braggadocio, whatever. I think that that's had a really big impact. And you combine that with the economic forces we've been talking about, and this is what you get.
Well, obviously having stable employment, especially when we're talking about, you know, the youngest of the young, I mean, teenagers, right? Teenagers and 20-somethings, who come from bad backgrounds and who are at the low income rung, are frankly the most like dangerous force in our society, right? Males. The crime spike we're seeing in some cities, including the nation's capital where I live, which is just appalling levels of crime, is by people, you know, it's almost better if they'd be in their mother's basement playing video games. They're out on the street, carjackings, grocery store robberies, that kind of thing. You know, how does that correspond to the devaluation of doing summer jobs? That kind of work is also something that is, I think, looked down upon now, frankly, by a lot of progressive people. I don't want, you know, 13-year-old child slaves or anything like that. But I've seen progressive now saying it would be like torture to expect a 15-year-old to flip burgers for a summer at a McDonald's. What's going on with that?
This is maybe one of my most cancelable opinions. I never hear anybody talking about this, but I'm going to talk about it because I think it's incredibly important. Children who are raised by a grown-up in the house who is not their biological parent are much more likely to be sexually molested. And there's a NYPD police detective who is in the book, Detective Patrick. He's a black cop. He spends a lot of time with the criminal element. He spent many a night sitting with them, in the hospital, you know, waiting for them to get arraigned and what have you. And a lot of them have been sexually molested. And I'm not saying that to take responsibility away from, you know, what they've done and their crimes, but the crisis in marriage, I think, has so many horrific implications that as a society, we're not ready to talk about. And we need to start talking about it because it's extremely important.
Terrifying. Well, we're getting toward the end of our time, so let's go big picture again. You know, what are some other solutions to improve the lives of the working class? Now, I know you and I don't see eye to eye on trade. I know you're a big fan of the Trump and then some of the Biden trade policies to have the look, I am fine with the microchips being manufactured in the country. I think I agree with you that we'd be better off if they were being built here rather than China. But, you know, we had that whole subsidy package, right? And my understanding is a lot of those factories are not being built because it turns out the regulations are still too exhausting and time-consuming and financially consuming that even with the subsidies, it's still too difficult to do these kinds of things. So then my question is really the problem that we have made work illegal in this country?
I think you and I would agree on the regulation front. People don't know this, but you know, countries in Scandinavia have very low corporate tax rates and very low regulation. So you know, they have very robust welfare state. But you know, when Senator Sanders likes to talk about these places as a utopia, he's really missing 50% of the picture there, which is the thing that makes it easy to become a corporation that then creates jobs, you know? That's very important, and I would agree with you. I mean, there's a lot of regulation. If you talk to small business owners, you know, again, another backbone of this country, it is so unfair, the level of regulation that they have to deal with. So I would totally agree with you there. I think I would say, excuse me, what I would say is that the sort of the major things that would improve working class life from the perspective of the working class is, yes, tariffs and protecting trade and making our trade have a more America first valence. Trump did a great job on this. And thank God Biden has sort of really carried the torch forward there. Housing, getting rid of zoning laws, immediately freeing up space and land to build duplexes and starter homes for working class people. Vocational training. My God, let's tell young men in high school that they don't have to learn Shakespeare and algebra to have the basics of a middle class life. Let's teach them how to become the skilled trades folks that we desperately, desperately need. Get rid of the diploma divide. Make it illegal to require a BA for a job that does not require a skill that you would learn in college. And make sure that people aren't using software that filters out people who don't have a college degree. These are all completely nonpartisan ideas that would have an immediate impact on the lives of working class Americans. Immediate. And, you know, it's not for one side or the other. These are things that all of us should be able to agree on. And these are solutions that I spoke to experts about and then brought back to the working class Americans I interviewed in the book to ask them what they think about them. So you can read about their take on them. They, of course, improved each and every one of them when we would talk about it because they know what would work for them. But these are all things that have their stamp of approval as well.
Yeah, eliminating degree requirements is a huge one and is so broadly popular and frankly is something that, you know, to end on a optimistic note, is being taken up. I believe Pennsylvania's governor, I think, signed into law something eliminating that requirement. Specific industries and firms are also eliminating it because it's popular to do so, and they're probably discovering that it doesn't. They, you know, to employ people again who spent more of their time jumping through hoops is not always a benefit, and is frankly sometimes detracts from the value of their work.
Absolutely, yes, yes. There is a lot of good news on that front. And then, you know, the last thing I would say is really immigration, you know, having a strong immigration policy, controlling the border, but also you know, limiting the number of immigrants who are coming in here because they are competing with the working class. They're not competing with us, Robbie. They're not competing with people in the knowledge industry or people who need a credential to do their job or people who need a command of the English language. You know, they're competing with people who use their bodies to work, and we should protect that labor. We should protect those Americans.
Well, there are high-skill immigrants coming into the country as well. That's just strictly limited by the government, right? The ones who are going to compete with us. But I think the country would be better off with more of them, and I will take the competition. But as you point out, that does speak to what you say about the policies of the elite, of the government, favoring the elites and being very, just not even listening to what the working class concerns are.
Absolutely.
Well, Batya, thank you so much for participating in this discussion of your book with me. It is fascinating. You did a terrific job on all this reporting, and I learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robbie. This was just such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. If you are interested in podcasts about nonfiction books, listen to C-SPAN's Book Notes Plus podcast for interviews with authors and historians hosted by Brian Lamb.